listener production.
Okay, are you recording?
G'day, you are listening to episode 209 of The Howie Games Part A, featuring Sarah Jones and in turn her pop, Jack Jones. Sarah, you would know as the star of Fox Footy.
How good is footy and how good is grand final day on Fox Footy, brought to you by the Ford F-150, the two best sides of season 2023 doing battle.
Jack, Sarah's pop you may not know, but I would love you to, hence this podcast. A bit of background before we get rolling. I need to lay this out for you, so bear with me. I first met Sarah many moons ago. I was working at Channel 7 as an assistant producer on a Sunday morning sports show called Sports World, hosted by the star that is Joanna Griggs, and Jonesy was the production assistant, I reckon. We both eventually left Channel 7 and Jonesy went and turned into a TV star. As for Jack, I met him, I was trying to figure this out, I think it was 2008 when I interviewed him for 10's Anzac Day football coverage, Jack having served in Papua New Guinea in the Second World War. I spent an hour and a half with Jack, and he left an enormous impression on me, enormous. Then, as I said, bear with me, when the podcast started in August 2016, we didn't really know what the show was. I thought, gee, Jack would be a good guest. So I rang Sarah and said, do you think he'll come on? She said, well, give him a call, but I reckon he will. Now, at this stage, most people had never heard of podcasts. So I rang Jack on his landline. Remember those kids? On his landline and invited him on. His response, of course I will, Mark. Now, what's a podcast? But he came on. So I picked Jack up from his place in Camberwell and drove him to Channel 10, and he held me spellbound. Spellbound as he told me the story of his life from growing up in Ascot Vale, supporting the Bombers in the VFL, going to war, and coming home to play for his beloved Essendon. I drove Jack home, and on a whim, I remember I was saying goodbye to him and I thought, I need to take a photo. So I took a selfie with Jack. It is that photo that is the icon for this episode. I love that photo. Jack's episode went to air as episode 6 way back in September 2016. Jack passed away in March 2020, age 95, right in the middle of COVID. So he wasn't afforded the funeral and love and respect that would have come his way from so many people he had met on his journey, which is not a shame, it's a travesty, actually. Anyway, whenever anyone now asks me, which episode would you recommend, the first one I say is Jack Jones. They say, who? I say, Jack Jones, just go back and listen to it. So Tommy, in a rare moment of clarity for Tommy, he suggested we needed to bring this episode back to the fore. It was a great idea. Being Anzac Day and all, and what better way to bring it back, again, Tommy's suggestion, than by preceding it with Sarah and her memories of her pop, the great man that was John Raymond Jones, a.k.a. Jack, a bloke that once called me his friend, something that made me feel incredibly proud. So firstly, here's Sarah. Someone I met when she was about 19 as the production assistant on Sports World. I think I mentioned it on the intro. She joins us to talk about her pop, Jack Jones. Sarah, how are you?
I'm good, Howie. A little weird being on the other side of the microphone. Control freak. I prefer to ask the questions.
How are you going to deal with that?
No, trust you. Known you a long time.
Yeah, a long time. We need to get you on this show to talk about you at some stage, but we are here to talk about pop, as you called him. Sarah, I listened to it, as did Tommy. Tommy, staying in Torquay, he drove down and listened to it yesterday, and I listened to it probably every 2 years. It's the only episode I ever listened back, and I listened to it on the way up here. And right at the end, Jack said, you know, it's nice to count you as a friend, and I got emotional listening to it. He's a wonderful man, your pop.
He certainly was, and I'm not a hugely emotional person. My family often teases me about the fact I'm quite clinical, but when I do talk about pop, I do get emotional because he was such a special person. And even having the podcast for Miller and Hallie and for all of the other great-grandchildren to listen to and one day for their children to listen to, I think is just a really special time capsule. I mean, we always say the elderly people in our life, we should ask them more questions and write them down and tap their knowledge, but no one kind of does. But for us to have this beautiful interview of pop and even just to hear his voice again is a really special thing. So I think it's lovely for the family to have, and he would love that I'm doing this with you. He would just be, he'd be up there somewhere right now with a cup of tea and a biscuit and just sitting in and relaxing. He would love it.
There's a cup of tea because he pointed out he didn't drink.
Didn't drink.
No, didn't drink and didn't smoke. And
he talked about after the 46th premiership, staying in the rooms till 3 a.m. and he was drinking lemon squash.
Yeah.
Come on, Jack.
But he had a wicked sweet tooth, so he could inhale all the sweets you would ever imagine. And he loved his food, which he's definitely passed on to me, I think.
Well, no one consumes as much chocolate as a game of football.
Correct.
As you do.
Correct.
So when I was thinking about doing this, and it was back in 2016, like it's
crazy. Yeah, a long time ago.
That the podcast is still here. I remember ringing you and saying, how do you reckon his recall will go? And you said, oh, no, he'll be fine. He's telling me the scores of the grand finals in the 40s. He's telling me the names of Carlton players he played against. He knew his number of the way he was registered through Victoria into the army. He was that sharp, Jonesy.
He was
at
really
91.
Sharp and right towards the end. So he passed away at 95 and he was sharp right till the end and we're so grateful for that. And Nan's much the same, very sharp, you know, in the elderly years of life.
Mary.
Yes. But also Pop just had that kind of personality. He knew the things. So even at 95, he would say he was 95 and a half when he passed away. Like he counted the half. He loved numbers. Like he loved that the 24th was his number at the battalion in the war and his number at Essendon. I was born on the 24th. His first daughter was born on the 24th. I'm the first grandchild. So, yeah, he just had that quirk of liking those things.
So regardless of him as a footballer or as a veteran, what was he like as a Pop? Like what's your first memories of spending time with him and Mary, who you call?
Nan. So my mum was killed in a car accident when I was 8 and that left Dad with the 5 of us kids to raise on his own. And so Nan and Pop, who lived in Melbourne, we were up in Echuca, but they had an incredible hands-on role in helping Dad raise us. They were always up in Echuca. We were always down in Melbourne. I remember Pop coming to, you know, every ballet concert, every netball game, always dressed to the nines and looking super sharp.
Good-looking man.
Him taking us to the football, you know, getting us into the rooms afterwards to meet the players. So in terms of that, he was very involved in our life and he and Nan and Dad's brothers and sisters, very helpful in Dad being able to raise us as a family.
And you're obviously a diehard Bomber. I know you're neutral doing your job,
but
you're as passionate as anyone I've seen. What looking back now, Jonesy, how was Jack viewed through your eyes at the footy club and at Essendon and when he took you into the rooms? How did people treat Jack?
I think the reverence they had for him.
It's a great word.
Was really special and something I'm really proud of. I was thinking about it before because Pop was a very gentle soul, a very calm personality. But at the same time, he was obviously very tough to have gone through the war and come back. And, you know, that generation of the Great Depression were a tough generation. So it was that balance of being through tough things but still being quite a soft and gentle personality. And he was a gentleman. So Dermot Brereton often says that he reminds, Pop reminded him of like a Cary Grant, like the old Hollywood idols, because he was very well dressed. He had impeccable manners. He treated everyone with kindness. And yeah, I mean, he loved the limelight. He loved the spotlight and the media world.
He was good on camera.
And yeah, like
he came to life when the camera was there, Jonesy.
And you know, he could spin a yarn and he could tell a tale. And I think that's why Anzac Day was such a great thing for him because, you know, he'd get up and about for Anzac Day each year to a chance to have a captive audience listening to him. And, you know, all the media outlets loved him because he was a performer.
Well, you've just showed me the Fox Footy teaser for Anzac Day, and it's based around Darcy Moore's incredible speech. But the first shot is the silver fox there at the MCG, isn't it?
And he looks $1 million, and like that'll be so special to see Pop still part of that because I do think obviously Kevin Sheedy is the godfather of Anzac Day and everything he did in the clubs bringing along. But I do think Pop has played a small part in the history of Anzac Day in being able to tie all the links. So to tie the football, to tie the veterans and to bring it all together. And I think for a good chunk, for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years there, he was a key part of that narrative and educating young kids. He'd take the club to the Shrine of Remembrance and do tours and things like that. So I like to think that Pops played a small role in making Anzac Day what it is today. So the fact that he's part of the Fox Footy Open so is really cool.
His descriptions of war were so matter-of-fact and revolved around mateship and no fear. When I don't think we ever discussed this, James. When we finished the podcast, he, in his quiet way, and he didn't call me how he used to call me Mark. He's like, "Oh, Mark, I want to apologise. I didn't want to talk about death." And I said, no, I understand it. And he said, you know, it just seemed such a waste to him, which he did intimate that he didn't really ever understand war. Did as you got older, did you ever engage him to talk about his experiences in the war?
Yeah, and I certainly, like, you know, being a budding journalist growing up, a lot of my stories I would write, we had to interview someone. Pop was such a good source of things to write about. A lot about the preparation, like the physical training they did. I think they did it up at Parkville, where my girls play netball now. The training they did, even things like to keep warm, you put a blanket underneath you and then you put a blanket on top in the jungle, and the food and the, like Pop got malaria when he was over there. So more those stories than the death and destruction. He was very lucky. I mean, he's picked up a hand grenade and survived, and that Pop was actually the most clumsy person on the planet. The fact that he survived the war and got to 95 was always a source of amusement for us all, because he was so accident prone in a really lovely kind of funny way. But yeah, I remember my brother, when we were kids, asking at the dinner table one night about the war and whether he'd shot anyone. Right. And we were all like, you can't ask
that. It's a pretty direct question.
Yeah, but just that childlike innocence, you know, for him it just seemed, you know, kids say the silliest things sometimes. And Pop just said, oh, we don't talk about those things. And that was probably the closest we came to him having to, you know, speak about the horrors of war. But he often talked about missing his mother in particular. And like he was a baby, he was 18, 19 year old.
19, so, well, his recall to talk about, you know, you ask a question like, can you remember when you got back home? And he straight away, and he started describing the street lights were blacked out and his mum wasn't home. She was at the top of the street. Like the recall is just, and then the fact that she made him, she threw rations and managed to get a tin of baked beans and he had nothing to eat in Papua New Guinea
except baked beans. I wonder too, though, because of the trauma of that experience of war, whether it does heighten your recall. So you do, you know, you remember, because it's such a pivotal moment. It's not just a everyday occurrence. It's something, you know, catastrophic. So maybe that was part of it. But yeah, and for a long time, probably until Anzac Day, he probably didn't share those experiences. So important to be able to share them now.
And what about his footy experiences? As we went through, it was 7 grand finals in 6 years.
Yeah, which
of
is
a draw.
Crazy. When you say that now, people go, oh, your Pop played for us. And I'm like, yeah, he played in 7 grand finals in 6 years.
Six
I mean,
years.
God, the Bombers would be happy to win a final at the moment, Howie, let alone play in.
Let's not go down that path, Jonesy.
Every year you're rocking up. And he also played in the first drawn grand final. And I can't remember off the top, but the scoreline that day,
7-27.
Ridiculous.
He talks about, and I remember looking it up later, because he was such a gentleman. He told me about a bloke who kicked 113 but wouldn't name him because
bless.
He said he was a good footballer. He just, you know, he was a bit inaccurate
that day. Can you imagine?
No.
Like, that's just, yeah. And also, so the way I think about it is I look at the great teams in recent years, so say Geelong and Hawthorn, and I think, okay, who will become a legend in the Hall of Fame? So I look at that great Hawthorn team, you think Buddy will be a legend one day, and maybe Luke Hodge, but probably beyond that, not really many. The Geelong team, Gary Ablett Jr. will be a legend, but I don't know many of the others.
Maybe Joel.
Pop played with 3 legends in the one team in Dick Reynolds, Bill Hutchison and John Coleman. So to get a sense of how good they were and compare it to, like, that's unbelievable.
And the humility of him to say, as I said, I just listened to it an hour ago, what are your memories of football if you had to summarise it, Jack? And he just said, I was lucky.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah. So do you have any, I was thinking about this, I saw a story on the news last night about memorabilia. Does the family have a premiership medal or a Essendon jumper, or does it have to?
Yeah, so Dad's got a trophy. I think it's a premiership. Was it? I don't think it was a medal back then. Right. I think it was a trophy that's up home in Moama.
Premiership trophy.
Yeah, and wow. We've got a great picture in our shed at home with all our luck memorabilia of Pop. And it's signed by various members, I think, of the 200 Club. We've got his war medals. Yeah, so we do have a little bit, not as much as we'd like I don't know what Nan did with his big V jumper and his Bombers jumper back in there. But, yeah, there's definitely some of that and some scrapbooking as well, you know, articles of these players, you know. It's pretty special stuff.
His advice about being married for, well, it was, I think it was 60-odd years at that point, maybe it was 64 years, his advice, James.
I'm intrigued to see what Pop would have said, right? Yep.
Now, Mark, you've got to understand in your family, in your house, who's the boss. And I'm like, so, Jack, who's the boss in your house? Mary. And if you don't understand that, you're going to have problems. So tell me about their relationship, because I relayed to him at the end. I picked him up from the place in Camberwell and he started telling me about Mary. And if you listen through to the podcast again, I remember clearly, and it brought it back to me, he had a big smile on his face. Yeah. And I remember thinking, I wasn't married at that stage. I remember thinking, wow, if I'm still with Erica in 50 years' time from the start, if I was smiling to talk about her like Jackie's about Mary, then I think I've probably had a pretty good life.
Yeah. Yeah, and they had like a great family, six children. It's funny you say that because they argued a lot. They were like a bickering couple. Right. And so we'd go out there and we'd have dinner and they'd be just arguing the sky's blue. No, the sky's purple. That was just Nan and Pop shtick and that's what they did. So it would be funny. I'd ring Dad and be like, Nan and Pop are arguing again. And he'd be like, stop it, you two. But yeah, they obviously loved each other very much and had a great partnership. And also I think difficult for Nan too, because I think in a different era, she would have had been a very educated woman and a career woman in addition to, you know, the family.
She's a woman of many interests, yeah.
Yes, very, very smart, very, like, well-read, et cetera. But the opportunities for her were so limited, really. You just got married and had children and that was what was expected and you had to run this show. So while Pop gets a lot of adulation for his football career and what he did, Nan was managing everything at home and doesn't get kudos, and I think it would be completely different in today's day
yes,
and
I think
age.
You're right.
You know, Nan's a real strong feminist in terms of, and has always instilled in us, you know, women can do anything and girls, you know, education is so important. She's really passionate about that. And it's, a snapshot of the time that Pop, you know, was the footballer that got all the attention, but, you know, Nan played an amazing role in raising the family. But, yeah, they were a very funny couple. It brings a smile to my face just thinking about. And even I remember going out for lunch with Nan and Pop when I was heavily pregnant with Miller, my eldest daughter, who's now 9. And so Nan and Pop would have been 90. And I just remember them saying, oh, we just can't wait till you have your little one and we can take them out for a hot chocolate. And I remember thinking, oh, no, surely you're not going to be around. Like, the fact you're 90 in here is a blessing.
Yeah.
And sure enough, like, my kids know their great-grandparents so well. They've had so much time with them and they got to do all the things. You know, Pop got to take them to the footy. And, yeah, it's really unbelievably blessed to have them so late in life.
Yeah, it's nice to hear that. It's when I spoke to Jack originally, I think I rang him on the home phone and he said, well, where would you like to do this interview? And I said, oh, well, we go wherever you're comfortable, we can do it at your house. He's like, oh, you know, Mark, Mary's been listening to me talk about footy for 64 years. You know, she won't want to hear me talk about footy anymore. Can we do it somewhere else? So, which is why we did it in at Channel 10. We're about to, well, I said to you before we did this, it's I think it's episode 6 or something.
Wow.
People
yeah.
haven't heard this. So I'm excited for people to hear it again. But just before we get to that, so if you could summarise Jack as a granddaughter, how would you describe him to people? Because they're about to hear his voice. How would you describe him?
I think he was just a gentleman and a special person who showed great interest in his family. He loved the three Fs. He loved footy, he loved food. food, but most of all, he loved his family. And I think he just led an exemplary life. And gosh, if we could all get to 95 and have made an impact like he did, I think you'd be pretty happy with yourself.
It's a great summation. Rather than me saying I'm going to put you on the spot, it'd be good if you would throw to what is coming up right now.
Sure. All right, here it is. What year was it?
2016.
Okay, way back in 2016, this is Mark Howard with former bomber Jack Jones.
Firstly, Jack, welcome to what I call the Howie Games. It's a great honour to sit here and have a chat with you. How are you going?
Good, thanks. Thank you for inviting me, Mark.
Oh, it's great to have you here. We're sitting here in Channel 10 at the moment, but I went and picked you up at your place in Canterbury/Camberwell. Beautiful house that you bought how long ago?
46 years ago.
46 years ago. We're having a chat in the car. Tell the people that are listening to the Howie Games, what did it cost you, Jack?
$17,000.
$17,000 Australian, which is sort of 10 or 12,000 US dollars. And I guess now it's worth, I don't know.
Oh, 1.2, 3, 4, 1.4, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I don't know.
Maybe 1.6.
I'll never know because I've got to stay it until I die.
They're not trying to kick you out of it, are they?
No.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? You bought that house, you know, 40 or 50 years ago and you were telling me you're a butcher at the time?
Yeah, that's right.
So what was a butcher earning back in Melbourne in the 1950s to buy a $17,000 house?
Oh, around about... $30.
30 bucks.
Oh, sorry, 30 pounds.
30 pounds.
$60.
$60. And so you just tuck away your mortgage, make your payment each. Did it take you long to pay off the $17,000?
No, not very long because the wages, $30 was very good wages actually.
Which is extraordinary because I guess the median house price in Melbourne, for those that don't know, it might be $800,000 to $900,000, and you old dog, snaffled yours for 17 grand.
Yeah, I was lucky I bought it in the right area at the right time.
Yeah, right. Now, listen, Jack, we're going to go way back. I had the pleasure of meeting you on Anzac Day maybe 7 or 8 years ago for Channel 10.
Yeah, that'd be right,
Mark. We sat down together and we see each other around at the footy. You're a great Essendon man in this part of the world, but I guess you always fascinated me, Jack, because, well, for a start, you're 91.
That's right, 91.
We'll get on to how you look so bloody good as a 91-year-old a bit later. But for those,
I don't know, you might reckon I look all right, but you want to see me in the morning.
If I look like you at 91, Jack, I'll be very happy with the life. What's the first memories, Jack? You were born in 1924.
Yeah, that's right. In Melbourne.
What are your first memories as a young person? What's the first thing you can remember?
Dick Reynolds probably played for Essendon.
Right, so this is the footy club is a massive part of your life. So you went along as a young bloke. Did your dad take you to the footy the first time?
Yes, he did. And Dick Reynolds played his first game in 1933, which is a long time ago. I was about just on 8 and a half, put it that way. And he was a great idol of everybody that lived in Essendon District, which I was born in Ascot Vale. That's Essendon District. And he was like what Bradman was to the whole of Australia.
Was he?
Bradman was honoured, you know, because of the Depression.
Yep.
Nobody had that many interests. There's only about 5 million in Australia at the time. And Dick Reynolds was similar to Bradman, only in the Essendon area, naturally.
So he was this great hope for the Essendon Football
Club.
Well,
that's right. You know, there wasn't a great deal of other sport played in those days, no soccer or anything like that, or what else, hockey, you know, it was mainly football. We used to get great crowds at the grand finals. Like, I can remember the 1949 grand final. There was 95,000 there officially.
Yep.
And we only used to get two tickets to get into the ground.
Right.
And I gave one to my mother and one to my wife. And I said, I'll pay to get in.
You were playing in this grand final.
Yeah, I was playing in the grand final.
You had to pay to get in the door.
Yeah, oh, well, because I gave me tickets away. I got a ticket to get in.
So one of the two tickets included you and you were playing.
Yeah.
Right.
That's right.
Right.
And I got to the gate at the ground and it was locked. Every gate was locked bar two.
At the MCG?
At the MCG, the players' gate, and also the MCG where you'll never get into the MCG. Because unless you got a ticket, I can remember Wally Grout, the great Australian wicketkeeper.
Yep.
he came without his ticket like me one day, and he jumped the turnstiles to get in.
So what did you do?
I waited there, and a Carlton. We were playing Carlton at the time, and Chuck Howell, the opposing ruckman, came along, and he said, "How you going, Jack?" Because we all knew one another more so probably in those days.
Yep.
Because we used to have after the match drinks and sandwiches and everything like that, and. He said, "You look worried." I said, "Yeah, I left my ticket at home." I told a fib, you know, and at any rate, he said, "Don't worry about it, Jack, I'll get you in." So he walked to the gate, gave his ticket to the gatekeeper, and he said, "Oh, by the way, I've never seen that bloke behind me in my life." which he would say, the opposition ruckman. Anyway, he walked about two paces, and we used to have Gladstone bags in those days, leather Gladstone bags, taking our gear to the football. And he had it above his shoulder. It was that tight packed. And he said, "I'll go around to your rooms and tell them that you've left your ticket at home, and I'll bring a ticket round for you to get in." So that happened, and the CEO went mad at me for giving the ticket away.
But you got to
get in the room and got changed and ran out onto the ground, and they're all around the boundary line, all the people around the boundary line, because in 1949 grand final, they broke the gates down at the Ponsford's end of the MCG, and about 10,000 people got into the ground for nothing.
So how many do you reckon was in there?
Well, I said probably, there was 95 officially, that's the official attendance.
Yep.
And I said, I cut it in half to me, blow things up a little bit. So I said 5,000. Anyway, we ran out onto the ground, and they're all sitting around the boundary line. We didn't know this. And anyway, I said, "I reckon 5,000 got in." So I'm running towards the boundary line of the first quarter, and I got pushed in the back by Jimmy Clark, a great Carlton player who I always liked. And he actually lived up at Tuca with my grandkids later on. And a voice said to me when I fell on the crowd, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I know that voice." I looked around and I said, "That was my brother." Remember, 95,000 officially in the game. I followed my brother. And I said, "What am I doing? What are you bloody doing here?" Because he was 4 years younger than me.
Right.
And the chap with him was a chap by the name of Pat Egan. And you wouldn't believe this, Mark, but the assistant coach at Essendon is his grandson.
Really?
Yeah, and that was my brother's best mate, Pat Egan. Now I got Matthew Egan at Essendon now. He's coaching the seconds this year.
He is.
And what a surprise.
So we're talking, we've sort of got onto footy very quickly here. We're talking the 1949 grand final. You blokes beat Carlton by 12-odd goals. But, Jack, I want to speak footy with you because it's a big part of your life. Before that, you're a young bloke growing up in Melbourne. You're in the Depression. So at what stage does school become not an option? What time? What age did you finish school?
Well, I finished school late 1938.
So what, were you 13 or 14, were you?
Yeah, I was 13, and they said, "Well, you know, I want to leave, but you couldn't leave until you were 14.
Right.
So they said, "Oh, well, nobody will know." So I left school at 13.
To do what?
And I didn't have a job, but I had to get out and get a job. And the first job was $1.25 for 48 hours. I'm not going to tell you what the job was.
Come on,
but
give me an idea.
That's what I got.
Give me an idea.
$1.25. Now, right. I was a messenger for a barber.
A barber?
That used to go around and sell stuff for your hair and
right.
things like that.
Oh, Brill cream or?
Yeah, everything
right.
like that, yeah.
$1.25 for 48 hours?
48 hours.
Gee, that's a long way to pay off that mortgage.
Well, even when I grew up again, you know, I think by the time I was an apprentice butcher, and by the time I went into the army, I was probably only getting £1.25, you know, which is
$2.50.
$2.25.
Right.
For 48 hours, no overtime in those days.
You mentioned joining the army. Before we get to that, we're talking 1938, and this will be a great history lesson for me, but sitting down at school, to me, the Second World War was always 1939 to 1945. So as a 14 or 15-year-old, can you cast your mind back, Jack, and Did you understand? Did the Australian people understand there was a war coming that was going to affect them or not?
Yeah, well, I was listening to the radio when the Prime Minister at the time, I just forget his name at the moment, but he announced that Australia was at war. That was in 1939.
So what did that mean to you as a 14-year-old in Melbourne?
I was just worried about my brother-in-law, one of his sister's husbands, if he might have to go to war, you know, and 3 years later I was called up when I turned 18. So
so how does that process happen? You're an apprentice butcher at this stage?
Yeah, well, I could have got out of it probably because I was only 18 and I was an apprentice, but I wanted to go in because all my mates who were in it at the moment, you know, a few months older than me, so I said I'd better go in as well. So I got a letter to go. Everybody at 18 got a letter to go and report for a medical and everything like that.
Do you remember going to that medical?
It was at Royal Park where the Royal Children's Hospital is at the moment. Right. And that's where the headquarter was for joining the army. And even when we come home, we had to go through there with another examination to get out of the army, you know.
So what was going on in the war at this stage? Now I guess we're in the early 40s. Do you even know the places? How are you finding out about what's happening in Germany and happening in Europe and London at the time?
Well, no, we got called up. We had a V number, just like a Victorian number in New South Wales, NS. And then when we got in and they were talking about sending us overseas, yep, which they couldn't do, so we joined the army and we got a VX number.
Right.
My number was VX148416.
I still remember it.
Yeah, and the first port of call I went to was at Watsonia. The barracks are still there, right, just the other side of Heidelberg.
Yep.
And we learned about hand grenades and machine guns and mortar bombs and everything like that.
What'd you learn about them, Jack? Like, does a bloke sit there and say?
I never saw a machine gun or anything. You know, you'd sit out in the park at they watch out here, and yep, they have instructors there telling you what was, and the Bren gun was the gun I carried during the first part of the war in New Guinea. We were dispatched to New Guinea, our battalion.
So at this stage, you're training at Watsonia, and you're with your mates. I guess you're making mates like any Aussie
bloke
does.
Didn't know anybody when went into the army.
So what made you want to join? Jack, what made you want to go on? Was it an adventure, or was it to help your country, or was it to be with your mates, or is it all of that?
I really don't know, to be honest. I really don't know. But just because my mates, some were in the Navy, some were in the Air Force, and I said, well, when the letter comes, well I just went up and passed the physical and everything like that. So then I got notification. I didn't say no, I wouldn't go in. And then I got notification I had to be at a certain time, and that's how it started.
You report, you tell your parents, your mum at this stage?
Yeah, well, my dad had died about 10 months previously.
Right.
And she just realised when I got the letter that I'd have to go into the army. And I didn't know that I could have got out of it anyway because I was an apprentice.
But she would have lived through the First World War, so she would have understood war.
Yes. My father didn't go to the First World War. They had a couple of young kids at the time, my eldest sister and that.
Did she say, for someone that lived through one of these, Jack, did she say to you, Jack, this is, you do this or don't do this, or just up to you?
Son? No, she didn't say much at all, really. But right. When I think back, I'm probably pretty selfish for not trying to get out, you know. Tell them I was an apprentice butcher and things like that. But I just wanted to go in. It's one of those things, when you're in, you wanted to get out.
But once you're in, it's a bit late.
Yeah, it was too late.
So you did, you continued your training in Victoria?
No, we went up to Canundra, just outside the Gold Coast.
Right.
It's about probably 15, 20 kilometres outside. There's all mountains and that. And we had an idea we might be going to the islands, you know, walking over all the mountains and yep, that. And we used to do with 30-mile marches in those days. What's that, about 45 kilometres?
It is, with your pack and...
Yeah, we used to do that every day pretty well.
Right. And it's bizarre, Jack, because I have no experience of war or my country being at a war that's close to us, which is what you're dealing with. So what was the general reason why you were going? What were your instructors or those above you saying, we're going to fight because of... Why?
Never told us anything.
Right.
we didn't know anything, and it was just like a job, you know. They're the boss. You just do what you're told.
So you finish your training, you're doing as you're told, and then what
happens?
Yeah,
we went
there?
To Townsville to get on the ship to go over. We didn't know where.
So you didn't? Well, you jump on the boat, you didn't know where you're going.
We got on the ship and we didn't know where we were going. And after about 3.5 days, I think, we had a Navy vessel called a Corvette that was zigzagging in front of us to keep the Japanese submarines away, naturally.
Yep.
And we never struck any. And when we pulled in, they told us that it was Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea. And we looked across at the very cloudy day and the mountains. You couldn't see the tops of the mountains. And we said, one of the chaps said, "Now I know why we did all that marching and all the training in the hills."
So we're talking 1943. I'll explain to you how far removed this is from my life. I've been to Papua New Guinea 3 times on surf trips, taking my dad up there and mates up there. And to me, it's this amazing tropical location with perfect waves, and there is history around the place. There's you can dive on wrecks of bombers and ships up at a place called Kavieng, way out in the east. I know it as a place of pumping surf, and I know that sounds wrong talking to you. What do you know Papua New Guinea as? Before you get into what happened there, I know it as a perfect wave. What do you know Papua New Guinea as?
Hills, mountains,
just hundreds of them.
Yeah, well, we never had any tanks with us up in New Guinea because they couldn't go over the terrain of the mountains and that, you know. It wasn't until we went to Bougainville that I ever saw a tank.
Right.
You know, so, no, it was very, very mountainous over there in New Guinea. And as I said, it's probably silly to say, but it was just like a job. You'd get up in the morning and you'd go out in patrol.
But before you did that, before you went out on your patrol, you're talking about a Corvette and making sure there was no Japanese subs there.
Yeah.
Did you understand the risks?
No, not really. It seems people often talk to my kids and that about it. And I said, well, you must have been worried. I said, well, what could you do? We were down the hole of the ship and it was about 90-degree heat down there, and there were 3-tier bunks about 18 inches wide. And the bottom one was only about 6 inches off the ground the ship. You could hear the waves on the side of the ship splashing up against it when it got a bit rough. But no, it's probably people say, no, you must have known. And I said, no, it was a job.
Right. It was a job.
The chaps would dive alongside you, in front of you, behind you, and with the mortar bombers coming over, and you couldn't hide from them. They'd have the spotters up trees, you know, for the mortar bombs, and they'd probably land 50 yards behind you, and then they'd say, we assume, they'd say, drop it back 50 yards, and then it dropped in amongst us, you know. We had a lot killed in a lot of those raids.
That's not a job then, though.
Well, it sure was, because you didn't even think about it. You got up every morning, you didn't know whether you're going to be still alive by the end of the day. What could you do? I know people can't understand that.
No, I have no understanding.
You couldn't
what
be
you're
frightened
saying.
Because you had to look after you. I had to look after you, for instance, and I had to look after that bloke there, you know.
So you didn't feel fear?
No, never felt fear at all.
Did it make you think about your life? You're only a young man. You're only like
I was only 19 when I first went to New Guinea.
So as a 19-year-old, did you view your life any differently when, at the end of the day, some of your mates weren't coming home from work, as you call it?
No, it's very, very hard to understand what I'm talking about, probably, but
it is.
You never had fear. You couldn't have it because you had to look after one another.
Back to Jack in a moment. Next up on the show, 3-time premiership captain at the Richmond Football Club, the star, that is Trent Cotchin.
Kind of don't have words, like, I think every person that watches Grand Final Day sits there and hopes that one day they'll get to do that.
Lift up the cup.
But I don't think I ever truly believe that I could do it.
Wow.
So I think in that moment it's kind of like, what the hell? This has transpired and happened. It's a special moment, but But what I realised is actually the journey along the way that is more special. You know, that day in itself was incredible and memories forever. But when you catch up with the group of guys that were involved or the people that were involved in that, or you're talking to other people, you never actually really talk about the day or those moments just after the game. It's all the little things that happened throughout the season, the Triple H stories, the, you know, in 2020 there was so many moments where we were bloody challenged. Like, but that's the stuff that brings you together and becomes part of the powerful part of the story.
That's Trent Cotchin next up on the show. Let's get back to Jack.
So you arrive in Papua New Guinea. We're backtracking a bit here. And then what's the plan? You're trying to stop the Japanese taking
over?
Well,
the plan was getting off the ship. They had rope ladders that you had to get over the rope.
Yep.
And there was a lot of barges waiting for us to take it to shore. And you'd climb down the steps. Some went down steps. Some went down the rope ladders. And you'd get in the barges and they'd all go towards the beach, you know, 20 or 30 barges.
Yep.
And they dropped the front of the barge and you might have seen it on television, war pictures of that. You dropped the front of the and you had to charge up the beach into the jungle. We were lucky. There was no Japanese there waiting for us. Yep. So we got onto the beach without anybody getting killed. And then we reformed together and then they had a base there that we'd camp at and we went from there. And then from then on you'd go up on patrols with, say, nine people.
Yep.
A lieutenant, a sergeant, a corporal, and a lance corporal, and about five others, and they'd go out and control. If you ever ran into a unit of Japanese that was, say, a platoon, you wouldn't attack them because you were too. You'd go back and report to base,
right?
And then you'd go back in the afternoon or the next day or something like that.
And so the entirety of your time there was spent in Port Moresby, going out from Port Moresby and coming back?
Oh, no, we didn't know. No, right. You just kept marching up the island, up the hills, up the mountains, I'm sorry.
So how far up the mountains are we going?
Oh, well,
now?
You're just mountain after mountain.
Right.
So and you just, you know, they'd have the signals there and tell us where the Japanese were because yep. They could tape into them and then the same of us probably.
They could what?
They could listen in to us.
Right.
And same as them probably. The last patrol I did up in Bougainville when we went to Bougainville later on, we had three in, on the patrol. That's how low we were getting as far as soldiers go, fighting soldiers. There's about 1,000 in a battalion,
yep.
But there's about 500 fighting soldiers. The rest is mortar platoons, signals and pioneers to get us over rivers and everything like that. And the colonels and that planning the war, you know, and tell them what we've got to do.
So are you on the Kokoda track at this point?
No, I was too young, thank God. I wouldn't be here today probably.
Yeah.
They lost a humorous amount of people up there.
So I don't know. It's hard to ask these questions, Jack. You're incredibly open about it and you seem very blasé about it. Can you take me into what happens when you see the enemy, when you see the Japanese? All my questions are ignorant questions because I have no understanding.
No, well, as I said, even we looked like if we were gone at one stage. Yeah, that's the first time I saw a tank, and that was behind us. If that wasn't there, I wouldn't be here today. But because this is in Bougainville, when we went to Bougainville, because terrain in Bougainville is more flat.
Right.
There's few hills, but no great big mountains like New Guinea.
Right.
You know, and we would have been gone. They were within 10 yards of us. And you just kept shooting, you know. That was the only time that we were told to fix bayonets. And just as they told us that, there wasn't many of us in that it was only one platoon, not the whole battalion.
Yep.
And there was people behind, the tank turned up behind us. And they just, you know, mowed them down, unfortunately, you know. I often think of the Japanese, like, they had parents, they had a mother and father, probably had a wife and a couple of kids at home, and here we are, both of us, shooting one another. It's just not real.
Did you think of that at the time? How did you view
them? No, we didn't think of it at the time because it was either you or them.
Or how did you view them at the time? Just as the enemy?
Yeah, just as the enemy.
Did you hate them?
No, well, I didn't. I never have, you know, because we've got enough problems in our own country at the moment with with people throwing young babies off.
We do, Jack.
The bridges and driving into big ponds and drowning them, and husbands killing wives and vice versa. And you got to get your own backyard in order before you start Christianising other countries, I reckon.
So you're there, and as you said, you just keep shooting, and you've got a mate beside you, I guess you've got to know pretty well, and he gets shot.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, they were strangers, but then they become real mates. So we lost 91 killed and 197 wounded.
Of our
battalion, but we was nowhere near the most that, like other battalions, some like 200 or 300, you know, killed, that is. But we were lucky in one way, but one's too many, let alone 91.
So what happens when you get home at the end of your day's work, as you call it, and one of your mates that you met and you did training with, or that you met along the way, or that you're on the boat with, he's not back there with you that night?
That's right. And when we did come back after losing somebody on a patrol, you'd come back and you'd clear an area about 30 metres and put a trip wire around the perimeter.
Yep.
And put a hand grenade in between two sticks, and then if the Japanese come, they'd trip over that and they'd alert us, and we'd be ready for it when they came in. That's how because it's pitch black and you see the stumps. You look out there and there's no big trees and there's only stumps, and you reckon that stump's moved, it might be a Japanese, but they would have tripped the tripwire, and the hand grenade when it went boom, you know. We know they're on the way.
Can you sleep in that situation?
Well, you had two. We used to dig a trench, and two of you in the trench, and you dig down 3 feet, and then about a foot wide, just enough for you to get in, or 8 inches wide, and then you dig under halfway down, and that's where you'd be 2 hours on, you looking out, and then the other bloke was asleep, or I was asleep, and after 2 hours, you'd wake him up, you'd go down underneath, and he'd come up.
Did you?
But no, I can honestly say we never had fear, or I didn't, because you had no time to think about it anyway. You had to keep going. You couldn't pull out, as the saying goes, because all your mates are with you.
So if I put it to you that and doing that is heroic, how do you look at the word heroic or hero?
Never even thought about it, no.
And now, looking back?
No, the only thing I like now is when we march and, you know, well, I'm the only one that's marched for the last 7 years with my battalion. I'm the leader now, even though I was only a little lance corporal.
Yeah.
And you know, it's sad to think that there might be a few more still alive, but they can't march, or they can't do this and they can't do that. And a lot of the wounded that we had, but one of the other battalions have lost twice as many as us, you know. So that's right. It's very, very sad.
Did you see things, Jack, you see other blokes do it, that you look back and think that was heroic, that saved someone, or that help their mate, or like I say,
no, we never ever thought
just doing what we had to do at work.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And I know it sounds,
it's bloody extraordinary, mate, when you talk about it.
It is,
like that.
But you couldn't afford to be sorrowful.
Yeah,
you know what are you doing? I always say that worry about the things you can handle, don't worry about things that you can't handle. So that was one of those positions that we were in.
Did you lose much weight? What'd you eat up there? What you packed down at the end of the night and you open your pack, what are you pulling out?
Oh, yeah, well, you're always tired, you just lay down with your clothes on. The one thing you'd never take off in the army up the islands is your boots.
Right.
Because if you lost your boots or took them off for a rest and they started to attack, you didn't have time to put them on, you'd never get anywhere without your boots. That was one of my, sounds silly, I know, but because you couldn't walk on the ground, there was spikes and, you know, undergrowth everywhere with no boots on, and the army boots, they were heavy, but they saved a lot of people.
And hot and wet up there, just hot and wet.
The humidity and that, it's unbelievable.
So are there meals? It's stuck in my head. Are there meals that stick in your mind? You get out of a tin, or is there things that you thought at the end of the war, geez, I'm never going to eat that again?
Well, I can always remember baked beans we used to have a lot of.
Right.
Because they were safe for us.
Yep.
And when I got home, my mother said, I was able to get a can of baked beans for you, Jack. And I didn't say anything, I ate them, but I said, I don't think I like them as much as I used to.
So how long were you up there? How long were you?
I was 10 months in New Guinea and 12 months in Bougainville.
Did you lose much weight in your time up there? Did you get sick?
No, I was pretty thin when I went in. I was well under 13 stone. I'm just under 6'1".
Yep.
And I haven't changed much as far as weight and everything. I played in probably few kilos more than what I am at the moment.
Did you get a feeling at any stage that you were winning or that you were losing?
Never knew. The thing I always laugh about is and the battalion, this is Cameron's Knoll, and that was one of our captains.
Right.
Or was it a little hill?
Right.
We've won that. Seems stupid.
Yeah.
So what? You know, like, We won this hill, we won that hill, but we were forcing them back to the end of the island.
Yep.
That was in Bougainville. That was 120 mile long and 9 mile wide. That's about 15 kilometres wide and 150, something like that long. And we had them down there as we thought. But it started raining in June and it never stopped and we couldn't cross the river to get at them.
Right.
And by that time we were ready to go over, they dropped the atomic bomb and we didn't have to get across the river, but we didn't know how many. They reckon there was a lot waiting for us. So about 1975 we got a letter from the battalion.
Yeah.
What do they call it? The that you could give it out after 30 years?
Oh, freedom information.
Freedom of information, that's the word I was looking for. And they say there was 18,000 Japanese on the other side of the river.
Oh, I'm bloody glad.
And
that,
we had about 1,000.
Well, I'm glad that river stayed up where it did then.
And I always hated them dropping the atomic bomb. But then again, I wouldn't be here if we had been able to cross the river with 18,000 Japanese waiting for it.
So how do you...
And I've got that in black and white. It's not a thing I've thought up.
Yeah.
And we got that around about 1975, I think.
Gee
whiz. What's that? That's 45. Yeah, about 30 years after the war. And we got a... Might have been 79 or something like that. And we got a letter. Everybody that was still alive, we got a letter from the battalion telling us how much of a predicament we were in, would have been in.
That is the end of Sarah and Jack Jones Part A. Stick around for Part B.